today is the latest in our Memo to the President series of events that explore the challenges and opportunities facing the President-elect and is jointly hosted by the Metro Program and the Presidential Transition Project. Now, we've already released 9 of these memos on issues such as decreasing poverty, promoting energy independence, rebuilding our financial institutions, and fixing the tax system, you know, some minor issues that we have. There'll be 2 more memos before the President-elect takes office a week from tomorrow. And today we're going to focus on how the President-elect can think about our nation's long-term prosperity through investments in American infrastructure. Now, we've done several events on infrastructure in recent months here, and every time I'm reminded what Margaret Thatcher once said to an audience like this. You and I come by road or rails. It's the economists that travel on infrastructure. Infrastructure, our ports, our airports, our bridges, our roads, our rail and transit systems, our water and sewer, our web of telecommunications, energy grids, that's the connective tissue of this country. And in our view, smart policies and investments in infrastructure can foster productive growth in our economy, sustainable growth that furthers energy independence and real solutions to climate change, and inclusive growth so that low and moderate income families have access to good schools and quality jobs and can share in a broader prosperity. The infrastructure challenges that face this country compel us to think out of the box and outside the nation for systemic structural solutions. Much of this we'll talk through this morning with a great lineup of speakers and panelists we've assembled. First, Governor Rendell will probably walk in at any moment. He just arrived by Amtrak, right? So we're talking about infrastructure. Following the governor will be New York Times economic columnist David Leonhardt, who will moderate a panel of metropolitan, state, and congressional leaders. And they'll share their perspectives on where and how the incoming administration should think about this critical issue. And so let me start with an overview of this memo we've prepared. Please make sure to pick up a copy of Your Way Out. I assume they're on a desk out there. By this point, it goes without saying, obviously, that the current economic situation is volatile and uncertain, and many are calling on the new administration to make a series of short and long-term investments to help the economy recover and restore prosperity. Now, infrastructure matters for multiple reasons to this conversation. It obviously matters to the American economy and the American job market. According to Bureau of Labor Statistics, in November 2008, nearly 12 million Americans were employed in occupations related to infrastructure provision. That's about 8.6% of total U.S. employment, down 4% from the same time last year. It obviously matters to people and, by extension, our energy future. Infrastructure-related expenditures cost American households $1.5 trillion each year, mostly in categories such as utilities and transportation. In fact, after housing, transportation is the second largest component of the average family's household budget, about 18 cents out of every dollar. And utilities such as electricity and natural gas consume about 7%. But they're disproportionately larger for low-income families, over 10%. Now, the federal presence, as everyone in this room knows, I recognize a lot of people, it's already substantial. The federal government spends about $80 billion each year on infrastructure, about one-third of the total non-defense federal investment annually. Now, two-thirds come in the form of direct aid to state and local governments for the construction and rehab of transportation facilities, highways, transit, rail, air. 19% goes to community and regional development, 8% for water and energy projects. Welcome, Governor. How are you? And 7% for the acquisition of equipment and land. Now, despite all this spending, the association between infrastructure spending and economic output is not clear. We do know that major projects such as the interstate, initiated in the 50s, are associated with step changes in productivity. We also know that productivity has not continued in recent decades, as investments have lost focus and direction and failed to focus in key areas. So what explains that failure and this disconnect? For one, our country has no overall national strategy for infrastructure. We therefore are not experiencing the same kinds of economic impacts from transformative investments like the interstates, or the social impacts from iconic projects like rural electrification, or the sustainability benefits from air and water pollution control programs from the 70s. In the absence of a unified strategy, we wind up with little or no targeting. Right now, because political considerations drive disbursements, most funding is spread like peanut butter on a slice of bread. We treat every part of this country as if it is exactly the same, rather than trying to advance national priorities, such as enhancing our competitiveness or promoting sustainable growth, or using comprehensive cost-benefit assessments in order to maximize our investments. Another flaw is that infrastructure policies are highly compartmentalized. They often work at cross purposes. They are hampered by lack of connections and cohesiveness. Take transportation. The United States is the only industrialized country in the world that fails to link aviation, rail, transit, and passenger rail. It's a crazy way to do business, and it's a recipe for duplication and waste. Equally disturbing is a pervasive lack of fact-gathering and analysis, what we call a frack-free zone. Federal agencies do not collect or analyze sufficient information on the results of the hundreds and hundreds of billions in spending. We simply can't manage what we can't measure. Now, in contrast to us, our global competitors are beginning to provide the kind of leadership many are calling on the U.S. government to provide. China is well on its way to building the most sophisticated network of ports and freight hubs in the world, while trying to replicate our network of advanced research institutions and universities. Germany is strengthening their rail and telecommunication connections between their major metros, and has recently developed the country's first master plan to strengthen freight and logistics. Spain has become a hothouse of alternative energy products in wind and solar, spawning new specializations in finance and investment and legal. And Britain and Denmark and other European countries routinely use an intricate web of data and metrics and analytic tools and spatial planning techniques to make infrastructure investments based on fact rather than political horse trading. When it comes to the United States, we need to learn from our global competitors in order to get more strategic and more disciplined. So what are we going to do? Well, the good news is the president-elect talked a lot about infrastructure in the campaign and has continued to talk a lot about it since the end of the campaign. And I think, frankly, for many of the people in this room, this is probably the first election campaign in modern memory where the word infrastructure was even uttered. He talked about a national infrastructure and reinvestment bank. He talked about the need to achieve energy independence. When he talked to the U.S. Conference of Mayors last June, he talked about the compelling need to join up transportation and housing and land use and energy and education in the metros that drive American prosperity. And then he talked about rural places and the need to make strategic and targeted investments in rural areas that meet their market dynamics. But one of the most important things that he said during this campaign and since is that we won't do it the old Washington way. We won't just throw money at the problem. So in other words, we have to invest, but we also need to reform. So when we think about the road ahead, we believe that this country requires a 21st century infrastructure vision. And to do so, it means we have to change the way we do business. Speed is important, but it's more important to get it done right. In the short term, the immediate term, we need to make sure that infrastructure reform is part of the administration's agenda. We need a National Recovery and Renewal Commission to oversee and track the spending from the economic recovery package and to develop a longer-term strategy for infrastructure development and economic recovery. Beyond the recovery package, we need to invest in coordination and information to harmonize the projects of the myriad federal agencies that construct, operate, maintain, use infrastructure, and leverage private sector financing. In the name of budget reform, we should aim for a thorough examination starting in fiscal 2011 in order to cull out the $80 billion in federal infrastructure spending. The Reform Commission can help do this, and they can also serve a temporary advisory function that guides the next generation of policy and implementation, and really help in the sequencing of the important pieces here that are expected to come down the pike in 2009 and 2010. Legislation on climate, legislation on energy, legislation on surface transportation. We also need a federalist vision for infrastructure investment, reform, and coordination between different levels of government and the private sector. Some specifics. As the president said, president-elect said, next week, we need a permanent, independent National Infrastructure and Reinvestment Bank to define and provide financial assistance to qualified infrastructure projects that matter to the nation as well as a group of multiple states. This is where the federal government needs fundamentally to lead again. What are some of the merit-based projects an infrastructure bank might consider? Unblocking goods movement through our major ports and gateways, the development of a smart electrical grid, the modernization of our antiquated air traffic control system, the upgrade of rural telecommunications and broadband, the improvement and expansion of inner-city passenger rail. The small-scale projects probably belong in an expanded community development block grant program. It's the large, market-shaping, energy-shaping, environment-shaping projects that belong in this infrastructure bank. Beyond that bank, let's make sure that the federal government empowers the metro areas that are the engines of national prosperity. We should have a sustainability challenge in this country where we would entice and fund partnerships that join up housing and transportation and energy and other systems across city and county borders. And each place in this country, each metro may decide to do different things. Maybe mixed-use facilities, maybe mixed-income housing close to transit, maybe congestion pricing, maybe commuter rail. It's all in the service of broader structural prosperity and sustainability. And then, and this may be the most delusional statement today, but I think it's coming, let's commit to evidence-based decision-making. Let's have that web of data and metrics and analytic tools and spatial planning techniques that are deployed routinely by our competitors. And that will enable us to determine how much money to spend and how to spend it better. If we do all these things, it will not just be about investing in quote-unquote projects. It will be about catalyzing a new American economy, a new green economy, about using market mechanisms like real-time pricing, about unleashing private sector investment and inventiveness to stimulate market-led responses. So let me end where I began. Today's fiscally constrained environment demands a new approach to infrastructure policy. The status quo does little to upgrade our existing infrastructure, expand choices in moving people and goods, make travel more accessible and affordable to families, nor does it help us move closer to energy independence. We know that the stakes are too high for economic recovery and fiscal responsibility to allow spending that does not result in real gains in productivity, inclusion, and environmental sustainability, and the foundations for short and long-term prosperity. So I firmly believe that we can act with vision, we can act with imagination, we can act with confidence, we can act in a way where the federal government again leads and leverages up the energy and the talent and the capacity of state and metro and local governments in this country and the private sector. And so that's the challenge here today. That's our memo to the president-elect. And now it is my pleasure to introduce the governor of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Ed Rendell. I first met Governor Rendell when he was mayor of the great city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I was chief of staff to Henry Cisneros. I won't tell you all that he shared with me about the capacity of the Public Housing Authority in Philadelphia at the time, or many of the other projects that we worked together during his tenure as mayor and during Henry Cisneros' tenure as secretary. But I would say that since taking over the governorship in Pennsylvania, and more recently in the last several years in a collaboration with Governor Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg, the Governor Rendell has probably done more than any other person in this country to put infrastructure on the national agenda and to describe it in such a way that we make the kind of investments we can, even in these tightly constrained environments, so that infrastructure becomes a vehicle for economic recovery, a vehicle for energy sustainability, and a vehicle for people achieving the American dream. With that, Governor Ed Rendell.
Good morning, everyone. Let me begin by, I don't even know if Bruce knows this, but the Philadelphia Housing Authority, to show you that government can effectuate real change, Philadelphia Housing Authority went from probably being the worst in the country at the time that Henry Cisneros and Bruce came to Philadelphia in the early 90s to perhaps the most effective in the country, and really has just reformed, has done more to reform the neighborhoods of Philadelphia than any single thing that's been done by the state, by the city, or any other part of the federal government. It's a real success story. We have a brilliant leader, a man by the name of Carl Green, who is as close to a benevolent dictator as you come, which supports my wife's theory that the country needs a benevolent dictator. But he has made tremendous progress, and it all started from what Henry Cisneros did with the Philadelphia Housing Authority. So change is possible, and that's the good news. The bad news is that I almost never correct Bruce, and the Brookings Institute has issued a number of reports that have been enormously helpful to us. My whole economic recovery plan for the Commonwealth, and I took over at a time when we were facing the worst budget crisis in our history, was centered on the Brookings Institute report about the older, small, and mid-sized cities in Pennsylvania, and we've gone a long way towards helping them regenerate, not as far as we need to go, but a long way. But President Clinton talked at length about infrastructure in the 1992 campaign. In fact, I remember when choosing a candidate to endorse, and I was the fairly new mayor of Philadelphia, I was impressed that he was the only one talking about infrastructure and went ahead and endorsed him. And what happened was, and I think President Clinton fully intended to deal with infrastructure, but when he became president, he, I think, rightly made the judgment that deficit reduction was the single most important thing that his administration had to undertake, and really spent most of the first six years reducing and eliminating the federal deficit. And as a result, infrastructure lost momentum. The one thing President Clinton did significantly was to impanel a commission on whether or not we should have a federal capital budget to fund infrastructure. That commission was headed by then John Corzine, who was at the time managing partner for Goldman Sachs, and Kathleen Brown, who was then the treasurer of the state of California. And I testified as mayor and as the head of Rebuild America at the time. And there was a lot of controversy, and the Office of Budget wasn't happy about the concept of a capital budget. And the commission, and I don't know if this is the history of commissions in Washington, but the commission took almost years of testimony and made no recommendation. Well, the economic crisis that's hitting our country is bad for so many, many different reasons. But I think it creates particular peril for those of us who care about infrastructure and believe that one of this country's imperative has to be fixing our infrastructure and fixing the way we fix infrastructure. Why is it a peril? Well, number one, because it does make it more difficult to do the long-range scale that infrastructure repair needs in this country, and I'll talk about that in a second. Just as it was impossible for Bill Clinton to do some of the things he wanted to do because deficit reduction was crucial to him, I worry that what's going to happen here is we're going to have a stimulus plan. It's going to have, let's say for the sake of argument, $100 billion in infrastructure, and that box is going to get checked off. Now we're on to healthcare or education. We've done something about infrastructure. Well, of course, $100 billion is nothing talking about infrastructure. Nothing talking about the German infrastructure or the Japanese infrastructure or the Chinese infrastructure. And it's surely nothing talking about the neglected and abused American infrastructure. So that's worry number one. We have to resolve to do the intermediate or long-term steps that Bruce recommends in the Brookings memo to the president. We have to resolve to do that and to do it in scale, once and for all. We have to make the sacrifices necessary to attack infrastructure in scale. And I worry that the economic climate is going to make that much more difficult to do, if not well-nigh impossible. And secondly, I think this is all creating a lot of confusion. The need to use infrastructure for stimulus. Obviously, if we're using infrastructure for stimulus, we want to do two things primarily. We want to create jobs. And the good news is we know that infrastructure does create jobs. It creates good-paying jobs that can't be outsourced. And it creates a lot of them. And secondly, we want to create orders for American factories, for concrete factories and asphalt factories and lumber factories and electrical supply factories and so many different American businesses who desperately need orders, who desperately need work so that they can get these orders and rehire people that they laid off, steel or you name it. Desperately need those orders going into American factories. And again, it can do just that. Now, to accomplish that goal and to be part of a recovery, to be part of combating what's happening out there now, speed is of the essence. There's no question about it. And out of the conference that President-elect Obama had with the 41 governors in Philadelphia came the use it or lose it proposal. And use it or lose it is a good idea, one, because it is a policing mechanism to make sure that speed is carried out, that the need for speed is carried out, and that we start creating jobs quickly. But use it or lose it also, for the first time, puts accountability, some accountability into the system. There is none. When you get federal grants now, there's virtually no chance of losing that money. And then thirdly, it also gives leverage. You need to be able to leverage the system if you want to move the system along. You can leverage your own bureaucrats on a state or local level and say, hey, folks, we just have less time to do this. You can leverage the private sector. You've got 120 days normally to respond to the RFP. You've got 30 days to respond to the RFP. There are so many steps in the process that are built in that are totally unnecessary or totally longer than they need to be. I always give the analogy if the wealthy multi-billionaire Bruce Katz walked into a law firm and said, I need you guys to do a financial transaction for me. It's very complicated, but I'm willing to pay good money to get it done. Here are the papers. Tell me tomorrow morning how long it'll take. And the managing partner of the firm comes back and says, oh, it's a very complicated transaction. And to do it at the caliber and the level of work that Struther does, it'll take 2 months. Mr. Katz takes out of his pocket a cashier's check for $10 million and lays it on the table and says, I need it next Tuesday. What do you think the managing partner says? Done. 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 And the same thing is true for the private sector. So we do need speed. There's no question about it, and we can't apologize for it. This is, in fact, in the first analysis, a recovery program. It's an economic program. Is infrastructure related to the economy? Of course it is. But in the first instance, it's a recovery program. So we need speed. Does that mean we need to do it in totally wasteful ways, in the same ways we've been doing it? No. We can put down markers, and we should put down markers now. One of the most important markers I think we should put down, and what I hear in the scuttlebutt, and I hear nothing more than anybody else hears. You know, people say, are you an Obama insider? And I remind them I wasn't even an Obama outsider during the primary. But I am president of the NGA, but I don't hear anything special. But I hear disturbing rumors that the infrastructure bank is in real danger of being tabled. Now, people say, well, that's okay, because you're basically doing mostly fixed, you know, repair projects, because those are the ones that are fastest. They don't need EISs, they don't need EAs, you know, you don't need to take any land. You can do your fix-it programs really fast. Well, that's true. But this is not the time to just do it business as usual and throw money at the states, throw money through the normal formula and say, go to it, use it or lose it. We're going to have an oversight board to see later on whether you spent the money wisely. This is a time to put down some markers. Is it a time to do all the things we want? No. Is it time to do thorough cost-benefit analysis on every project? No. Is it time to look at some of the environmental regulations that can be speeded up? No, we don't have time to do any of that. But is it a time to put down markers like no pork? Yes, it is. This is the time. He has an 82% approval rating. He's never going to have a higher approval rating. He has the American people on his side. He has to press one button and send out one email, and he'll get letters and emails into congressmen's offices that make the NRA look like a second-class organization. He can do it, and now's the time to do it. If we're going to change this, let's set down markers now. If we let this program become porked up, then what's the hope for the long-term necessary infrastructure program? Infrastructure Bank, give it, if it's $100 billion, give the Infrastructure Bank $6 billion and have it go out and use that to raise private capital. And maybe let's do something about private activity bonds, and maybe let's take a look at TIFIA, do some things to get the private activity bank juicing. Private investment, even in this tough marketplace, private investment is available for infrastructure. And the bank, properly capitalized, could be a real good first step for doing that. And we've got to do it. We've got to put the marker down. Dodd, Hagel, Felix Roth, and it's all there. We can do that. And we can do it as a pilot project. We can do it. But let's start putting the marker down. And Bruce is absolutely right. If I were to chart out the future of how infrastructure is going to be done in this country, and one of the things that Bruce's memo makes clear, and Brookings' memo makes clear, is that infrastructure isn't all about transportation. And that's a point we have all got to remember. In our poll, and I'm going to talk a little bit about BAF's poll at the end, roads and highways didn't even finish first. Energy infrastructure finished first in the nation's, in the minds of the people of this country. So it's about more things than just that. And it's about public safety, and it's about quality of life with congestion, but it's also desperately about economic competitiveness. If you want to really understand the scope of how far we need to go in this country on infrastructure, just look up on the internet a recent article in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette about locks and dams in southwest Pennsylvania. Does anybody know? I'm not even sure Bruce knows this. You know, I sort of think Bruce knows everything, but do you know that there's a federal inland waterways trust fund? Who knew that? Raise your hand. Two tickets to the next Nationals World Series game. to anybody who knew that. I didn't know it, and it was central to the way we repair locks and dams. Locks and dams in southwest Pennsylvania have reached such an emergency situation that it's possible that a lock or a dam will fail there. And if it fails, it will end for a significant period of time, maybe a half a year or longer. It'll end waterway traffic in southwest Pennsylvania. And the waterway there serves two major steel plants, the largest coke-producing facility in the United States of America, and five coal-burning plants that are very important to getting electricity in our grid. That's what can happen if that gets screwed up. The Federal Inland Waterways Trust Fund has been underfunded for years because it's a user fee and the users have refused to pay any more, and there's been no will in Washington to raise the fee, and we're in desperate trouble. We're in desperate trouble of dam collapses. The federal dam program. Does anybody know how long it's been since the federal government's properly funded the repair and maintenance of our dams? Decades and decades and decades, and there are dams ready to break, just like there are bridges ready to collapse. This is a national imperative, and it's very important that the short-run program, where the focus has to be on job creation and has to be on producing orders, be done in a way, to the extent that it can, where we set down those important markers. As little a pork as possible, a federal infrastructure bank, some, if not initial cost-benefit analysis, certainly oversight on projects, and use it or lose it. Those are good basic things to put into the hierarchy. And then let's move ahead to what's the long-term vision. As soon as the economic stimulus or recovery plan passes, I would hope that President Obama would, in the White House itself, and the Recovery and Renewal Council, and obviously, Bruce, he's gone along the lines already of producing something that fits with your recommendation. That's an important body. But in the end, and all of you know this, anybody who's dealt with the federal government knows it, if something's going to move, it has to move in the White House. It has to move in the White House. President-elect Obama did a wonderful thing on climate change by giving, by appointing Cal Browner to coordinate all of the climate change efforts that touch on so many different departments. We ought to appoint someone like that on infrastructure in the White House, because infrastructure involves 5, 6, 7 different federal departments, commerce, EPA, energy, of course, transportation. So many different things are rolled into what infrastructure involves, and we should have that type of control and that type of mission in the White House. And we should begin planning on how are we going to deal with this country's infrastructure funding gap. And Bruce is right. On the one hand, we have increased funding to infrastructure. But on the other hand, it's piddling. When Dwight David Eisenhower left office, 12.5% of the domestic non-military spending in this country was devoted to infrastructure. Today, it's less than 2.5%. We devote about 1/7 of our GDP to infrastructure compared to the EU. And a minuscule fraction compared to China, India, Spain, nations like that, who are making major investments in infrastructure. And virtually everything we do in life, education, energy, communications, all revolves around, are we going to have a first-class infrastructure for this country? The American Society of Civil Engineers says we have a $1.6 trillion infrastructure gap, and that's just to properly maintain and repair and maintain what we have. That's not talking about building an inner-city rail system. It's not talking about any new giant projects. I tested that. I asked all of my department heads to give me an idea of what our infrastructure gap was in Pennsylvania. We're normally about 5% of the nation, Pennsylvania. Interestingly, without any coaching, it came back from all of my cabinet secretaries that we had an $80 billion infrastructure gap. For those of you who aren't quick mathematicians, eerily, $80 billion is 5% of $1.6 trillion. So I think the American Society of Civil Engineers is fairly right on. The Surface Transportation Committee recommended increasing infrastructure spending from $80 billion a year to $220 billion a year. Ashtow just said over the next 5 years we need to up infrastructure spending by $545 billion on top of what we're already spending. So those two things are fairly consistent. There's no question that we need to do this. And if you broaden the definition of infrastructure, you broaden, is broadband infrastructure? I believe it is. The one thing rural America needs more than anything is broadband. Are we going to have a renewable energy economy? Sure we are, but we're going to have to build the grid out to take it to places where we're producing wind and solar. And we better start doing it fast if we want to have a viable, renewable, and alternative energy economy. So what are we to do? How are we to meet these goals? Well, again, not by checking off the box after the stimulus program is passed, but rather by the day after the stimulus program is passed, have people start working on the long-term goals. Because the long-term goals has its first test in the reauthorization of ICE-T. And whether that'll be in late 2009 or pushed back to 2010, we can't let that bill be reauthorized business as usual. If it is, we're cooked. We're fried. We have no chance of being competitive. None. With the rest of the world and infrastructure. So we've got to get to work on the long term as quickly as we can. And the Brookings report, the memo, is absolutely right on that. And I would add my suggestion to how we do this. There are many ways to fund infrastructure, none of which is easy. Should we raise the gas tax? Well, there may be reasons for raising the gas tax, and there's some good ones. That's a possibility. Is it politically viable? Not very certain. Should we allow states to toll previously constructed interstates and new interstates without having to go back to the federal government for approval? Of course we should. Infrastructure, like many things, is funded most easily and best if it's a user fee. And We should do that. Should we get private capital involved in infrastructure, whether it's by leasing some of our infrastructure to private industry or making it attractive to invest in things like an infrastructure bank? Of course we should. But in the last analysis, if we are going to, let's assume for the moment that to do some of the new stuff will cost another $500 billion. And let's say we've got a $2.1 trillion infrastructure gap. To meet that, we have to change the way we finance infrastructure. It can no longer be a part of the operating budget. It isn't anywhere else. It isn't in any city. It isn't in any state. It isn't in any county. We would no more finance infrastructure repairs out of our operating budget in Pennsylvania. I mean, it makes no sense at all. You're financing a bridge that will have a 40 or 50 year lifespan the same way you finance buying paperclips that have a 5 day lifespan. It makes no sense. And when infrastructure has to compete with the military, when it has to compete with social programs, because it's long term, it's always going to come in second or third or fourth or off the radar screen. We've got to get a federal capital budget. And my idea, once we get the appropriate money, and you'll say, well, a federal capital budget, even if you wanted to do $2 trillion of infrastructure spending, that's about $180 billion a year in debt service. Now, $180 billion a year might have a familiar ring to you. By the way, that used to be a whole lot of money. Not so much anymore. But if it has a familiar ring to you, it's probably because the cumulative costs of funding the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan are roughly $180 billion a year. It is amazing how we find money when we want to and don't find it when we don't want to. I remember years ago when I was mayor, I came down and testified before the Senate Finance Committee, and Lloyd Benson was the chair, a great, great American, and we made this plea for the cities, and the cities were in terrible shape. This was in the beginning of the 90s, and we sure were, and we asked for $5 billion to be invested in the cities, and Senator Benson looked down at me, and he said, Mayor, we'd like to help, but, you know, $5 billion, we just don't have that type of money here. And I said, Senator, no disrespect, but unless I miss my guess, you all just sent $5 billion to help repair and revitalize the country of Russia. So you do have the money. It's just a question of what your priorities are. And we have got to, all of us, starting at the local level, and the reason that Governor Schwarzenegger and Mayor Bloomberg and I, started this is because we've got to build a national consensus for infrastructure. We've got to get infrastructure on the radar screen. To that extent, this concentration on infrastructure and the recovery is probably a good idea. It's got Americans thinking infrastructure. But we've got to get by the check-off-the-box mentality that'll come from the stimulus plan. What I'd like to see in the long-term funding is basically what Bruce just outlined here. All of the major projects, all of the projects that are going to change sustainability, are going to change climate control, are going to really change the way we move freight, the interstate projects, the inner city projects, all of those be funded through the infrastructure bank, a bank staffed by a board that is professionals, that aren't politicians, that make their analysis based on the benefit to the country, the cost, the benefit, cost-benefit analysis. What good is it going to do? Is it going to reduce cost? Is it going to reduce congestion? It is going to make us more competitive. Is it going to tie our airline industry into our freight industry, rail freight industry? Is it intermodal? All of those things. All of those major projects, and I'd like to see that funded through some form of capital budget. And then you're never going to escape Congress's need to provide money to each and every state for transportation. Provide a smaller amount of money through some formula, but even with that formula, have some cost-benefit analysis built in and certainly oversight built in. So if a project is wasted, or if the money is wasted, or if it doesn't get done, you lose money the next time. You lose money the next time. There was a great program that Henry Cisneros started in HUD. It was on the books, but he was the first secretary to use it, called the HUD 108 Loan Program. Up until Henry Cisneros, it had never been used. Henry changed a few of the requirements and limitations and made it usable. And it said that cities could use HUD 108, their CDBG allocation, which in my case when I became mayor was $72 million a year. We could use five times that yearly allocation to guarantee loans for development projects in the city limits. Philadelphia had $360 million worth of capacity. I guaranteed $355 million of loans. Guarantee meaning it made it very easy. The loan came in from the federal government to the developer. If the developer defaulted, we, the city, would pay for it. If the developer had a $5 million default the next year after that, instead of $72 million, our CDBG allocation dropped to $67 million. In my 8 years as mayor, using $355 million of capacity, we had $4 million of default. We made up for that by the arbitrage on the money. We didn't lose a dime in CDBG. But the fact that we could have lost it made us extremely careful about what loans we use the guarantee for. So you can construct a system where we still give grants to the states, where the politicians can still say, I delivered this money, but the major projects, the sea change projects, the ones that will benefit our environment and our economic competitiveness and our climate, those are the ones that will go through the National Infrastructure Bank. So can we do this? Can we, after the recovery program is signed, sealed, and delivered, can we keep the momentum going for infrastructure? Well, I believe we can, and I want to leave you with some results from the poll that BAF, Building America's Future, took. We used Luntz Maslin. Frank Luntz did a poll for us at Rebuilding America in 1998, and we used Frank back then because we didn't want the Republican Congress to think we were cooking the books with some liberal Democratic pollster. So we took Frank, and Frank just did a recent poll. And the poll results were stunning. First, there is universal support for infrastructure. 81% of Americans said they would be willing to pay 1% more on their federal income tax for infrastructure improvements. That support was bipartisan. Three-quarters of McCain voters said they would spend the 1% more on their federal income tax, and 90% of the Obama voters. But the American people wanted accountability. The single most important factor after that they voted for, 61% said the most important thing in an infrastructure program was accountability. It's amazing how smart the American people are. It's amazing. They wanted it to be comprehensive. They knew it wasn't just highways and roads and bridges. In fact, energy infrastructure ranked number one, ahead of highways and roads, which ranked number two. American people are getting smarter. And they wanted it to be a result of partnerships. They think that the local and federal and state government should all get together and do this. So the groundwork for building this type of public support for infrastructure exists. It exists. And it is just necessary for me, in my judgment, to get this done, to have infrastructure be like so many issues on Capitol Hill that are so effectively funded. It has to be nonstop. It can't go away. If we don't get an infrastructure bank as part of the recovery plan, as part of a pilot project, we should be up there the next day saying, okay, you couldn't do it as part of the recovery. Let's do it now. Let's do it for next iced tea. Let's get rolling. Let's do this. Let's do that. Let's look at a capital budget. Everybody now seems to think we need a capital budget. Nancy Pelosi, Howard Dean. I was watching Howard Dean on MSNBC. He spoke out for a federal capital budget. Newt Gingrich says we'll never do infrastructure right as long as we continue to fund the federal budget the way we do. It's time. This is a seminal time for America. We've got a new president coming in. He's got great ratings. His party controls the Congress, and I know sometimes it's harder to control your own party than the opposite party, but it has to be done, and the way to do it is for everyone to support this effort. Everyone to support this effort. We've got to be there for the president. We've got to push him when necessary, but we've got to be there to support him all the way. This is, to me, one of the basic challenges facing this country. It's right up there with education and health care in terms of the nation's future. If we're going to remain economically competitive, we've got to change. When Governor Schwarzenegger, Mayor Bloomberg, and I announced the formation of BAF, we did it in the middle of a freeway in California, and we did it at 10 in the morning on a Saturday. It was still a pretty frightening experience to have that traffic whizzing by. I can't imagine doing it at rush hour. But we each had a little prop, and I chose for my prop a map of China and a map of the U.S. And I had pins in the map of the 10 largest ports in China and the 10 largest ports in the United States. 10 largest ports in China have a throughput of almost 3.5 times the tonnage and container space size than the U.S. ports do, almost 3.5 times. Only two U.S. ports, Newark, New York, and Long Beach, L.A., would have cracked the top 10 in China. Bruce told you about how well China moves goods. If we don't, we're sunk. We're absolutely sunk. We ought to be making major investments in our freight system. Pennsylvania is struggling, as every state in the nation is. We're struggling less than most big states. But I just made a $35 million capital commitment to building, helping to build an infrastructure right across the mid-Atlantic states so that we can move rail freight. We have to raise bridges so that they can accommodate these double-stack cars. There are 6 states involved. We were the first state to make the commitment. $35 million is not an easy commitment for us to make, but I made it because it's vital to our economy. It's vital to our economic competitiveness. When we can move freight that way, Pennsylvania becomes an enormously desirable place because goods movement right now is one of the factors, one of the key factors in bottom lines of business. The ability to move goods cheaply and quickly is crucial. So we've got to get on the stick. We can do it. The American people, as I said, are smarter than we think they are. They need to be led. They need to be led by political leaders, but they need to be led by business leaders and academicians and people who support the Institute here and by the Institute itself. We can do this, and if we do, it'll be a wonderful step towards a brighter future for this country. Thank you all very, very much.
This image of you standing along a California freeway is a little frightening. We have time for some questions. Anyone in the audience who wants to take a first stab?
Governor Rendell, you just mentioned a project that's of interest to me, the Mid-Atlantic Rail Operations Project. And what occurred to me as you said that is a project like that has languished for a number of years. It's been a very good project, but it's languished. And the federal government doesn't seem to be constructed or organized to be able to deal with interstate rail projects. What would you suggest to the Obama administration so that projects like that, and there are numbers of them around the country, can be led by the federal government as opposed to being the last party to know?
Well, let me say about this project. It's one, CSX has a really terrific young CEO, and CSX is putting a third of the money in. They've asked the 6 states for a third of the money cumulatively and the federal government for a third of the money. As I said, Pennsylvania was the first state, but I believe my fellow governors are going to kick in quickly, whether they get the federal government money or not. The problem about interstate projects is that the way we fund transportation now makes it very difficult. We've been trying to get funding for a railroad, high-speed rail line from the Poconos above Scranton through the Lehigh Valley, across New Jersey to connect to the tube to get into Manhattan. Right now, Pennsylvanians, the two fastest growing counties in Pennsylvania are Pike and Monroe in the Poconos because New York City residents are coming to live there, even though it's almost a 4-hour commute in a car. If we can make that train ride, you know, an hour and 15 minutes, and we can, we'd have it knocked. We'd have it knocked, and it would be so important to commerce and everything else, not just for Pennsylvania, but for North Jersey as well. But funding an interstate project like that is virtually impossible the way we fund transportation now. Do you want to?
No, I mean, absolutely. I mean, generally the way we've described it is we have a system that's built for a different century, different challenges, different imperatives, and the modernizing that has to occur, particularly across the state lines and across the metro lines, is quite significant. Thoughts? I've got one in the back here, Bob.
Governor, you've laid out a very bold, You've laid out a bold agenda for the infrastructure bank and the rest of it, and
seems like the politics in this town haven't quite caught up with that. And the analogy I'd like to use is that I got a leaky roof, a flooding basement, and five kids, and the bold vision is I'm going to fix the roof and put a pump in the basement. And how do we move beyond that to create the kind of bold and compelling vision that was really implicit in everything that you said here? You said energy independence, you talked about competitiveness and so forth. How do we get the Congress and the administration to raise the new administration to raise their sights to do that?
Well, I think we all have to continue to pressure. Look, I think President Obama's instincts, or President-elect Obama's instincts, are terrific. They're there. But are his instincts getting eroded by this need to build consensus or by, you know, dealing with his own party? I fear that that's the process that may be going on. I sent a message, you know, and again, I'm not an insider, but I called Valerie Jarrett, who I think is an insider, and I said, Valerie, don't throw away the infrastructure bank. Don't. Make it a pilot. I don't care what the pressure is in Congress. It's a crucial first step. We've got to do it. I mean, change isn't going to come easy to this country. Change is not going to come easy. You can't just talk about it. There's going to be a time when the president's going to have to play hardball with his own party and obviously with the other side. You know, if you have your own party in check, you know, it's great to get Republican votes, and I guess you need one or two or three in the Senate. But, you know, you've got to push ahead, and you've got to have that vision and go for it. That's number one. And number two, I mean, we've got to revitalize. I think this election was a great tribute to Barack Obama and his personal skills and the skills he had in the campaign, but it was also a great tribute to the American people wanting change. And somebody has to kick into that. And the reason when I decided we needed to form something to take the place of Rebuild America, I wanted Arnold Schwarzenegger and Mike Bloomberg was, first of all, they've made tremendous commitments to spending money for infrastructure in their own venues, and they have. But secondly, they're stars. They're stars. It's like twins all over again, you know? I mean, we're in great shape. They're stars. I can go anywhere and speak about infrastructure, and other than down here, this, you know, I'd be lucky to get a fifth of this crowd. But if we bring Governor Schwarzenegger in or Mayor Bloomberg in, we get tons of people. And it's important to get people like that willing to talk about it and give both of them credit. They were willing to sign on to this project at a time when they both thought that in the near future they would no longer be in elective office because they care about it. And we've got to keep doing that. I mean, you know, infrastructure isn't sexy. It isn't sexy. It can be and it should be, but it isn't right now. So we've got to keep it in the forefront, and we've got to keep the pressure even on our best friend, which is Barack Obama right now. Don't let up. If any of you care about the infrastructure bank, and I know you do, let's let them hear from us.
I've got maybe one more, and then we're going to move to the panel. So.
Governor, earlier you discussed the importance of getting orders in American factories, ASAP. Does this mean you're in favor of a Buy American provision? The Buy American provision?
To the extent that it can be done without violating some of the WTO requirements, absolutely. And because of I think the way you do it, you know, I always used to, when I was mayor of Philadelphia, we had all these civil service requirements for bidding, et cetera. And I didn't try to go around them, you know, because you couldn't, and it would be a long, drawn-out legal battle. We just wrote the RFP in a way that it made it impossible for anybody but the incumbent vendor. I wanted to reward incumbent vendors who had done a good job. Nowhere else but government can you have an incumbent vendor who's done a great job, and you can't just re-up them. You know, in private industry, if someone has done a great job for you, has cut your costs by 30% and improved output, you'd sign them up in a minute. But we had to rebid that. So we sent out an RFP that had so many little things in it that only the incumbent could have known. So to the extent that we can do it legally with the WTO by putting speed requirements on it, I would do it. You know, there's no question about this. I mean, if we're going to use steel, and I think we're going to use a lot of steel to fix bridges and things like that, it ought to be American steel. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about it. And I don't know how the Jones Act gets around the WTO, but to the extent that we do it with the Jones Act, I'd like to see us take a look at it here. Absolutely.
Well, first of all, thank Governor Rendell. If Schwarzenegger and Bloomberg are the twins, I'm not not sure what which character you're playing. We're going to make a transition, and I think it's a really important transition because there's been a lot of conversation about the federal government, and now we have to talk to some extent about federalism and the fact that at the end of the day, this is a partnership between the federal, state, local, metropolitan governments and the private sector, and therefore we need a more comprehensive perspective about infrastructure reform, because as the federal government gets its act together, as everyone in this room knows, ultimately, there's a delivery system that has to be changed. To lead this conversation, there's no one better than David Leonhardt from the New York Times, who has written specifically on the need and imperative for change in infrastructure over the past several months with regard to the Recovery Act, but also with regard to the longer-term vision that Governor Rendell spelled out. So I'm going to turn it over to David and look forward to the panel's conversation. Thanks.
First of all, thank you, Bruce. Thank you, Governor. We can tell you're excited about infrastructure if you manage to spend an hour talking about it and not mention the Eagles or the Steelers this morning. We have a great panel here, and I just want to introduce the panel, and that's about it. It's a panel that has people from all over the country, different regions, and from federal and from state and local and from the private sector. So I'm going to do that. Each panelist is going to spend a few minutes talking, and then we're going to, I'm going to ask some questions, and I want to encourage the panelists to be brief in their answers, but also not to wait for me if you have something to say to one of the other panelists. Please just jump in. So I want to start in the middle. I'm going to start in the middle with Congressman Donna Edwards, who represents Maryland's 4th Congressional District, which is comprised of both PG and Montgomery counties. She was sworn into the House in June of 2008, and she currently serves on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, among other committees. We also have here Deb Miller, who's the Secretary of Transportation in Kansas. She was appointed by Governor Kathleen Sebelius. She's the first woman to lead the Kansas Department of Transportation, and it's more than 3,200 employees. She's a native Kansan, and she also is a player on the national stage. Last year, she became chairman of the National Transportation Research Board's Executive Committee. 4th from my end, we have Patricia Mulroy, general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. She joined the water district more than 20 years ago and became its general manager in 1989, which by my math means she had a very rapid rise. We have closest to me, Stuart Rogel, who's the chief executive officer of the Tampa Bay Partnership, which was founded in 1994. It's the regional economic development organization for a 7-county area in west central Florida. This is something of a homecoming for Stuart. He was raised here in Washington. And on the far end, we have Rob Puentes, who I've described in print as the infrastructure maven of the Brookings Institution. The formal version of that is he directs the Metropolitan Policy Program's Metropolitan Infrastructure Initiative. And you have more information on all these folks in the bios that are available here. So with that, I'm going to start it off, and we are going to begin with the candidates' opening remarks, which they've promised to keep to 5 minutes or less.
Do this from here, or
do it there? What are you more comfortable with?
Sure, I can do this here. I'll probably stand up, though. Good morning. I'm Donna Edwards from Maryland, and I'm hoping not to rip this microphone. Thank you all so much for being here this morning, and for Brookings for putting this on. I never thought a couple of years ago when I first started running for Congress, and I would talk about infrastructure and have to actually spell the word and then describe what it meant and the need to invest in America's infrastructure, and particularly in my district, which is just outside of Washington, D.C., in Prince George's and Montgomery counties. But now everybody's talking about infrastructure, and infrastructure because it's about job creation, but also because we need to invest in America's infrastructure because it's falling apart. And it's falling apart whether you're talking about the water and the sewer, the transit and transportation, highways, roads, our rail system from freight rail to passenger rail, water and sewer, our energy grid, all of it is just falling apart. It's not keeping up with the pace of the 21st century, and it's impacting our competitiveness in addition to just making it really difficult for some of us to get around. Now, I had been speaking for a long time about water infrastructure in the context of, in this region anyway, the need to protect and preserve the Chesapeake Bay and our other waterways. Then a couple of weeks ago, there was a little water main break out in Bethesda, Maryland. Mm. And in a place where people thought, oh, and the infrastructure just must be fine, it turns out it was about a, you know, decades-old water pipe transmission line that looked, when it burst, like the Colorado River streaming down River Road. And so, you know, we're kind of waking up a little bit that infrastructure also means investing in water and sewer. Maryland had, or our region had, I think about 1,500 water main breaks between January and November of last year. And I would note, and I would note that that didn't include, obviously, River Road, but it also, one of the most important water main breaks that happened a week and a half ago up underneath my son's car in front of my house. So at 1 o'clock in the morning, I went to greet the three-man crew mm-hmm. that came out from WSSC, mm-hmm. and I was in my, you know, my robe and my hat, and it was freezing cold outside, and these guys do amazing work in the middle of the night, and this was their third call okay. that night. I offered them coffee, and surprising, none of them drank coffee, but they were busy, you know, sort of pummeling and digging to get down to the water main to try to seal it off and kind of patch it up for the night, and they managed to do that. It took about 4 hours to do, and like the good doobie congresswoman I am, I took pictures because I wanted to see the kind of work that they do and the intensity that it takes, and this was a very small water main break. We're in a really small community, but it meant that our water service was disrupted. It meant that the next day, turning on the water, you saw the, you know, the gook kind of coming out before you got to the real water. And you can see how, if that happens on a large scale all around the country, that the impact for our communities is really tremendous. I sort of first got my running start running for Congress, actually talking about infrastructure, about the need to put rail over the Wilson Bridge and to build a purple line around our beltway, because in this area, some of our children and many of our adults are suffering from respiratory illnesses that are just so compounded because of air quality, because we spend all of our time on roads and we don't have, you know, adequate mass transportation and a transit system that really works for people. And so I look across in my car as I sat in my two-hour commute this morning, 2 hours to drive 14 miles it took me this morning. And as I sat there, I thought, I looked over and all the cars, everybody, one person in a car, in every single car, and we were talking and shaving and eating and you know, doing all kinds of things, in the car. And we could have all actually been on a metro line, on a train. We could have been carpooling. We could have been in rapid buses and gotten to work, all of us, a lot sooner. And so the need is really, really tremendous around the country. And we're getting ready to get started. And, you know, we've been having conversations. I know I have with our House leadership. I actually sit on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Who knew we were going to be so busy? Mm-hmm. But we will be. We'll be busy in trying to create some jobs and projects that are ready to go in the stimulus package. But then, on a bigger scale, we'll be working on some major new authorizations for transportation that I hope takes a real, you know, a deep and systemic view of how we need to do our transportation policy over this next generation, the way that we need to think regionally, the way that we need to think about our rural areas and our suburban areas, because as much as I'm screaming about our transportation here in the suburban area, there are people in rural Kansas and rural Nebraska who are screaming about the same things. And so I'm very excited to be here today with our panelists, and, you know, to support the efforts of governors like my governor, who are saying, you know what, we have a lot of ready to go projects, but if at the federal level you require me to come up with a match, I'm facing a $2 billion deficit. There's no way that I can do that. And so you've got to help me out there. If you want some of these projects ready to go that also have a deep systemic impact, then require us to make those kinds of investments so that we aren't just pouring only money into the quick resurfacing kinds of projects. And I think that you know, sometime over this next year or so, I know that WSSC, if you're out there, you're going to get to repair the street that you messed up also in front of my, my house. But we have a tremendous opportunity here for job creation, but also to enhance our competitiveness in every sort of venue of infrastructure. And I will close on this because a part of this infrastructure conversation, I believe, is also about deployment of broadband. I just share lots of personal stories, and so at my house, I do still have dial-up service. Now, Verizon is telling me these days that now I can probably get Fios. I'm not really quite so sure about that, but that also means that the elementary school that is in horrible condition is populated with young people who aren't getting what they need in these new technologies because they have dial-up also. And so it's less a problem for me, but it really is a problem for our young people. And that is true in pockets of urban communities and suburban communities, as well as it is true in rural communities. And so I believe that those kind of investments, when we think of infrastructure in a broad kind of way, in a systemic way, water, sewer, power, broadband, all the transit and transportation, we're going to get this right for job creation, and we're going to get it right as well for our competitiveness for the 21st century. So I'll close there and look forward to the other panelists and to our discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, Congresswoman, I hope you're very busy on the T&I committee because there's lots that needs to be done. I really appreciate it. I'm Deb Miller. I'm from the Kansas Department of Transportation. So when we talk about these rural issues, I'm certainly familiar with those. But I think overall, one of the issues I want to put on the table is just seconding many of the things I heard Governor Rendell say. Reform is so important. You know, we have a transportation system in America that was built probably over 150 years. Different mode layers, never meant to meet or to work together at those times, built by different bureaucracies. Some are privately owned, some are publicly owned, some are owned at the federal level, some are owned at the state level, some are owned at the municipal level. I mean, it's really kind of a mess. And when I look at what I read about what's happening in China, I think one of the things we need to be very concerned about there is not just that they're making major investments, but in some ways, because they didn't have the amazing transportation system that we had in the last century, they're building an amazing transportation system for the next century, and that's not at all where we are. And I think when we think about this fragmentation, it's not just the way that the system was built, but I have to say, even our bureaucracies, and Congressman, if you'll forgive me, one of the issues, you know, even look at the way our congressional committees are organized. You have separate committees that deal with transit, that deal with roads and highways, and, you know, that's not a very good way to run the system either. So we really have to use the energy and, quite frankly, the fear, I think, that's been generated by the collapse in our economy to push forward with major reform. And even though I come from a state DOT and primarily the transportation dollars flow through state DOTs, I think we will make a mistake as we move to the future if we're not looking for other ways to deliver these services. Certainly, state DOTs are the owners and operators of the primary transportation systems. They're excellent at what they do, and we need to keep them engaged. But we've got lots of examples of problems that are bigger than any individual state, and states, quite frankly, don't get to them. I was fascinated by the governor's example of the $35 million investment. That's just another one of those examples. Those things don't get done because they're not inside any state's borders. And as much as we'd like to say we work together, quite frankly, we get very driven by the priorities of our own governors, of the legislature, of communities, of projects that have been on the drawing board for 25 years, and you're still getting political pressure to do them, and to think that we can bridge these huge national problems, I don't think it's going to happen. And the final thing I would say, just in terms of setting things up, one of the things we've all got to start doing is understanding that what might be to our benefit is not always a project built inside our borders. Improving our ports and improving that rail and freight network might do more to benefit the Kansas economy than a whole long set of projects we might build in the state of Kansas. And I want to say clearly, that's not to say we don't have a long list of very important projects to build in the state of Kansas. But the things that we need clearly are outside of our borders, and we will not get anything done without really strong federal leadership. I would honestly say I have been appalled by the language I've heard out of USDOT in the last year or so, talking about, you know, transition. transitioning the program down to the states. Private investment, I'm absolutely all for it, but to act as though the only way we're going to solve this problem is through private investment and to think that the U.S. government can step out of a leadership role, I think is an absolute disaster for our country, and I'll leave it there until we get into the discussion.
Pat?
Well, I'm here from Las Vegas, probably the most water-challenged place in the United States. And before anybody asks me a question, I don't care about the Mob Museum. not on my list of infrastructure priorities. And I'll leave that to our good mayor to handle. When I was listening to Governor Rendell, the thing that struck me the most was his emphasis on strategic investment. And I want to focus on the long term. Yes, we have forgotten this country's water and wastewater infrastructure. We take it for granted. We always laugh in the water community that the reason we get forgotten is we build the greatest structures in the world and then we bury them. Mm-hmm. Hence, we've taken it for granted. But we need to look at water and wastewater infrastructure in another way, and one that I have not heard discussed in any great depth or with any kind of emphasis. We're in the midst of a decadal climate change. That decadal climate change, not only do we have to invest heavily in energy to begin to turn the corner and stop the changes that are ahead, but what we have not spent time talking about is how are we going to adapt? There are 8 of us, large municipals across the country, that have come together as a climate coalition because we recognize that this could destroy the very underpinnings of every economy in the United States. Whether it's dikes that are going to break from rising ocean levels, whether it is wastewater and water treatment plants that are situated on the banks of rivers that could be flooded out and destroy the water quality of those rivers, or whether it is, as it is right now in the West, the most dire and desperate drought situation that we've ever experienced. Southern California is the 5th largest economy in the world. It is very much facing the real possibility of having a major water crisis in 2010. The Colorado River flows are so low, 3 more years of this protracted drought, Southern Nevada loses 40% of its water supply. 2 more years after that, we lose 90% of our water supply. We have not spent any time in this country investing in the science of climate change in any kind of a concerted fashion. We need to understand where the floods are going to occur. We need to understand where the drought conditions are going to become protracted. And before we start making long-term investments